Kind of
And
like it's like is happening with musicians on sound.xyz, or is happening all over crypto with these creator economy tools that empower creators to connect directly with their audiences. So scientists can be creators too. And are.
they are creators. They're the original creators, arguably.
Yeah.
So, welcome, team, and everyone listening to the 22nd episode of the DeSci podcast. I'm here today with two-thirds of the Molecule Legal team. We got Jesse and Chris. I'll let them introduce themselves briefly, but not much you need to know about them other than that they're some pretty boring lawyers. I'm the exciting one on the call. I'm on Molecule's product team, where basically I spend my days trying to get the legal team to let us do things that they otherwise are trying to stop us from doing. But yeah, so in all jokes aside, it's been super fun building with the lawyers we have on the call. And yeah, definitely wanted to give them a platform to share all their brilliant thoughts, which have impacted the protocol tremendously. So yeah, we'll let them introduce themselves and we can go from there.
Well, Benji, you know, they call the legal department the Department of No. So it's not only no, you can't do that, but also here's what you should know.
You're telling me
Yeah.
like this as if I didn't know it, but appreciate the reminder.
No, you know it well by now. I mean,
You're in
especially
the know,
in
Benji.
crypto,
You're
the
in the
legal
know.
department is a blocker, right, Chris? Yeah, it's often a blocker. And actually, some people close in our community, that's their default position. Legal should be a blocker. And that's right. But sometimes legal can be an enabler. And, you know, in my opinion, it's in the service of the founders and the vision of the founders that we can do our best work. So I'm Jesse Hudson. I'm an attorney based in Chicago and built my practice initially at the Chicago Board of Trade, which has the claim to fame of being the place where the highest volume of crypto is traded in the world of any city, mainly because of the big exchanges there, and also the place where the option contract was created. So a lot of financial innovation has come out of the Board of Trade, and I had the good fortune of beginning my career in that space. In Molecule, I serve as the chief legal architect, which means helping to structure the product, the protocol, in the ecosystem that we're building to foster decentralized science.
And I'm Chris Burns. I'm an IP legal advisor at Molecule. I'm an IP attorney by trade, with somewhat of an odd background, in as much as I also have a master's of theological studies from Divinity School, which oddly enough ends up being super useful in kind of thinking creatively about all this stuff that we're building. I'm based in the mountains of Madrid in Spain. Been here for about 4 years, but before that have was in Silicon Valley, was in the Bay Area, was in Washington, D.C. I've kind of worked across all different types of IP legal matters, cut my teeth as kind of a patent litigator, but do a lot of experimental intellectual property licensing work, and am especially interested in hacking the IP legal system and intellectual property as an asset class. It's been my whole foray into Web3 really just came about because of Molecule and because of the really exciting vision and innovation that Molecule's had with the IP NFT. And so one scene just in my mind, brilliant product and vision and need in a market, I was immediately drawn in. And then as soon as I got to meet this team of people that we work with, it locked me in. You know, it was the cinch. We have such an amazing group of people that we get to work with. And I think so much of the success of what we're launching is a true testament to this really amazing team.
Awesome. Thanks for that, guys. So, as I was thinking about what we could potentially discuss here, first of all, wanted to focus very much on the recent product launch that you both worked very hard on, the IP token launch, which happened a few weeks ago. But also just more broadly about your position on the legal team within Molecule, where, there's two pieces here. One of them is, in a lot of ways, the protocol that we're building, this IP protocol, legal is the foundation, right? It's as if the law is the product itself, that you're helping to increase the transactability of legal agreements. But the other is the piece of the legal team, which is like you're the army, right? Like this is compliance, right? We're stepping into a minefield by kind of trying to innovate here. And it's important that, you guys help protect us and not help us get trapped and step on a mine. So definitely want to focus on the former just because, I think lots of people are aware about all of the, wars that are going on from a regulatory perspective. But and I guess this kind of goes into your prior practice, Chris, which is like and so maybe I'll direct this first question to you, but from your experience with IP law, like what made something like Molecule so attractive and specifically around how what we're doing can disrupt your prior work?
Great question. The intellectual property justice system as a whole is widely seen across all types of IP stakeholders as in serious need of repair. People critique it from different angles, but I've really rarely met either an IP lawyer or people who are really active in the IP space and in the IP market in particular, who can't identify quickly five sort of fundamental issues that they think need to be fixed. First of which is IP quality, IP validation. There's roughly 50% of all patents that are litigated are found to be invalid if there's an actual decision on the merits. Other issues involve the sheer cost of participation in the IP justice system. If you want to resolve an IP dispute, you're gonna start at like six figures in legal fees and quickly get into seven figures before you could ever really get a ruling from a judge. This market and this dynamic is what fuels the patent troll problem, a problem that is prominent in big tech. It's coming into biotech and into life sciences. It's been slower moving into this market for reasons that are specific to biotech patents. But as soon as software becomes integrated into any market, patent trolls flock. The patent troll market itself, there's been estimates of, well, over half of all patent litigation filed in the US is filed by trolls. Big tech companies are sued weekly. Your Apples and Googles of the world by patent trolls. And so, over the past 15 years or so, there's been a tremendous amount of innovation in the market through defensive patent aggregation, through different types of network effects where entities are pooling together and understanding that collective action to solve structural inefficiencies in the IP market are powerful and profitable. This happens at the same time that there are a lot of efforts to actually change IP law and IP policy at the state level, but typically lobbyists sort of butt heads with between big tech and big pharma. Each of them have very different ideas about how the IP system should work, and they both have, enough money to throw their weight around in the US, in Washington, to ensure that really what ends up happening is the laws don't really change to solve the issue. So after I was doing patent litigation for a handful of years, for half a decade, I was litigating a lot at the International Trade Commission, which is a very intense patent court. I switched over to an entity called RPX. It stands for Rational Patent Exchange, and it's essentially a defensive patent aggregator where I was doing patent risk management, managing insurance claims. I've seen hundreds and been involved in hundreds of patent dispute settlements. And then I've spent a long time thinking about the economics of the sort of political economy of IP. Web3 and the opportunity to tokenize intellectual property completely transforms the game. It's through tokenization and through the liquidity that accompanies tokenization that we can all of a sudden have a brand new tool and sort of vector of interacting with the, again, I'll call it the political economy of IP, and I can talk about that more why if that sounds too esoteric, but tokenization of IP really does enable more democratic ownership of IP, better early sort of stage IP validation, and therefore can also help improve IP quality. And then similarly, this can really help us to bust up a lot of the concentrated market power that exists in the legacy IP economy in ways that are really beneficial to the public and to what public law should be able to solve and which lobbyists oftentimes block. Web3 and tokenized IP offer a brand new way in for us to create a more efficient system that is more fundamentally aligned, in my view, with the underlying intentions of intellectual property in the first place.
Awesome. Super helpful. Thanks for that, Chris. That's some great background. And yeah, I think you really kind of nailed a lot of the issues around like the quality and validity of patents, the cost of enforcement, the ability of trolls to kind of wreak havoc on the system that leave just a lot of vulnerabilities that, basically pave the path of Web3 to potentially be this new enforcement mechanism. So kind of dovetailing off that, Chris, I see your expertise is like very much into the IP system itself. How IP is transacted, formed, et cetera. I see Jesse's more on the capital formation side. So forming entities, capital formation around those entities to push forward some sort of a mission or goal. So Jesse, I guess like from this perspective, how do you see something like the Molecule Protocol being useful around the capital formation side of things around IP versus the IP itself? Yeah, how do you see this being useful over an existing system where you can just, start a C corp, raise money from venture capital, et cetera? Would love to hear your thoughts there.
Thanks, Benji. I mean, to me, it rests on the fundamental principles of crypto, cryptocurrency. And one of those fundamental principles is democratization. I think it's a very strong democratizing force for humanity. And so, how does that translate into capital formation? Well, initially, it translated it in the form of what started essentially with the Ethereum ICO, which is this open participation fundraise for the development of Ethereum protocol. And it took flight in 2017 during the ICO boom, which had its merits and also significant drawbacks. And over time, I think this idea has emerged that permissionless capital formation for all kinds of things is one of the best ways to foster entrepreneurship. And like the CEO of Spotify just said recently in their announcement releasing their AI Sidekick, entrepreneurs are heroes and we should invest time in them because they're the lifeblood of the economy. And there's been a fair amount of legislation passed in the US in relatively recent years to try to facilitate that. The most famous is called the Jobs Act, which has exemptions from securities registration requirements, such as Regulation D, that's quite famous for accredited investor rounds and some limited rounds, including unaccredited investors, as well as crowdfunding. And the whole crowdfunding and equity crowdfunding boom has emerged from that, as well as Regulation S, which focuses on offshore transactions to non-US persons by non-US companies, essentially. And then requirements for how those assets that are sold in Regulation S transactions come back into the US. But the purpose of the Jobs Act, the public policy there was to facilitate entrepreneurship, which is very much what the technology that we're engaging with now, this new internet, does. It helps to facilitate entrepreneurship through facilitating capital formation in a more democratic means. And so, how does that translate to science? And how does that translate to corporate forms? First, it translates to science because it empowers scientists to be more entrepreneurial. It empowers scientists to have more permissionless capital formation for their research projects to get their research funded rather than going through a Byzantine system of NIH grants or other grants with a lot of overhead and intermediaries. Instead, they can go directly to their supporter group and have capital formation through that supporter group on crypto rails, this democratizing thing. Which brings up one of the second principles of crypto, that is disintermediation. So by disintermediating all of these intermediaries that take cuts and make the process very hard, the process of fundraising for scientific research is simplified and disintermediated through crypto, which I think is also very, very powerful. And the third thing that disrupts is corporations themselves. There's an ease of forming a company on Ethereum or on another blockchain that is an order of magnitude easier than forming a company with a Secretary of State in any country in the world. And in orders of magnitude cheaper. You can spin up a multi-signature scheme and wrap that with some kind of corporate wrapper for like in a few clicks. And in doing so, you've formed what is essentially like a general partnership. And then when you add legal wrappers, you can create companies around that. But when you kind of remove all the legal wrappers and everything, what you have at the most basic level is a group of people who want to work together for a common cause, direct their common resources to do so. And tokenization and DAOs and all of the amazing infrastructure that people have built on Ethereum, especially where we operate over the past few years, has created this foundation for a boom in funding of science in a disintermediated, more democratic, less reliant on old school corporations way that I think puts us at the precipice of a very similar event that happened when the joint stock corporation was invented. Where when that happened, there was an unprecedented economic boom. You had tons more entrepreneurship, tons more people forming companies, and GDP increased substantially. Here, similarly, with the invention of DAOs, I think we have a successor to the joint stock corporation that is easier to form, easier to coordinate, and more multi-jurisdictional.
That's an awesome answer. And so, like if I'm kind of summarizing everything you said there, it's really around like reducing barriers to entry for scientists and researchers to fund their research and protect it, to basically free them to, solve the problems they're trying to solve rather than worry about all of these distractions to their work, just being able to do the minimum necessary actions to, fund and execute the work that they want to do, and minimizing the things that they have to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Kind of
Any
like it's like is happening with musicians on sound.xyz, or is happening all over crypto with these creator economy tools that empower creators to connect directly with their audiences. So scientists can be creators too. And are.
They are creators. They're the original creators, arguably.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I guess
Although
what?
our liberation theologist friend may
Oh
disagree with that on the
no,
original
I
creator.
was going to add that from the lens of intellectual property, all of us are artists, truly, because copyright applies automatically to every scribble we write down without even having to register it. And it is in at least, to not be too US centric about it, but the US system is the one that has imprinted the whole global system of IP. When we talk about this progress clause and the whole rationale for IP in the first place, intellectual property is really only there to promote the progress of science and the useful arts. Science in this parlance actually meaning knowledge production, more like artistic expression and creativity, and useful arts, meaning industrial property and patents. But absolutely, in any kind of coherent under sort of framework and understanding of what intellectual property is doing in the economy, we all are artists, artisans, and creators. And I think it's important that we all kind of occupy that role and feel proud of ourselves as, conscious, it's consciousness contributing to some type of knowledge production in the universe.
The Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation repeats this phrase all the time, which is, "Thou art that."
Thou art that. Nice.
Nice.
Anyways, Benji, sorry to derail a little bit
No,
into
no.
philosophy.
Love derailing into philosophy. And actually, let's double down there. So I guess, we've been talking a lot about intellectual property thus far, and I think it's pretty easy to get lost in the weeds of the complexity of it. And I think what you guys are doing right now is actually coming back to the simplification of it, which I think is important to, basically crystallize. So I guess from my perspective, not being a lawyer, to me, like what intellectual property is, it's the ability to protect the creations of your mind such that you can be rewarded for them. That's really it, to incentivize creating as much as possible so that people can progress and flourish. Where is that wrong? And do you want to explain like the different ways that governments protect that overarching kind of definition?
So I think your definition is fine. From a really technical perspective, all intellectual property is granting to its owner is a right to exclude others from their creative work, from their creative expression. It doesn't, if you get a patent, you do not have an affirmative right to sell, an invention. You can get a patent on a drug that the FDA might never allow to go to market. It would be illegal if you actually sold that molecule. But you would still, with this legal deed, have a right to exclude others from the illegal sale of that
Yeah,
molecule or
but
whatever it might be.
isn't that exclusion just kind of a surrogate and like a proxy for commercializing it?
It is, and that's how it's oftentimes been used. But if we just want to boil it down to the fundamentals, it's simply a right to exclude. And when you really want to think about it, it's a right to exclude others from an intangible, non-rival asset. It's absurd from if we're materialists about this. The idea of saying, well, we have this theory. I should pause for a moment and say the intellectual property system is modeled somewhat awkwardly on the real property system. And so we're constantly talking about analogizing patents as this kind of fence, a parcel of land, just like you would think of a parcel of land. Of course, economics, Lockean economics and European sort of Enlightenment economics have a lot of great ideas and theories around how things should work and how one should maximize the sort of productive output of land. But those all tend to be built around and justify the need for a private property right there through what is typically a logic of the tragedy of the commons. The idea that if we allow a common pasture in a town to be grazed, it's going to be overgrazed unless someone is a sole proprietor who's actually going to want to make sure it isn't overgrazed and there's some accountability there. That's also because that land, if one cow eats the grass, another cow can't. Now let's flip to intellectual property. Intangible, right? We can't touch it. Non-rival, meaning that if one cow eats the grass, another million cows can eat the exact same grass. It's much more like a candle with a flame, and if we're, a gathering of 1,000 of us and one person has a lit candle, everyone else, you can just pass the flame, and the first person holding the candle still has their lit candle. They kind of lose nothing from it. And this function phenomena of knowledge and sort of intellectual work has this problem, Benji, that it creates a problem inside our economic system. That says, well, then there's going to be no incentivization to actually scale things that are really expensive to bring to market. And people who sink all these upfront costs and actually doing R&D have no means to recapture it without some system. Now, that system doesn't have to be the system that we have, but the system that we have is the IP system in its current form. But in this way, I mean, it's true, it's intellectual property, but also if you just want to think of the looseness with which intellectual property applies, like I have just have some scribbles here. This stuff is nonsense. There's no aesthetic quality to it. That's copyright protected. That's IP just because I etched on it. It's much more imaginary property than intellectual in the sense that one doesn't have to be well educated or anything to participate in the IP economy. Patents, of course, it's difficult to get one if you don't have a lot of education because these are technical. But IP as an asset class generally is just this thing that we do to try and, as Jesse was sort of talking about, and celebrate and promote entrepreneurs. Now, yeah, there are alternatives, but yeah, so in that vein, I think it part of the reason I want to hone in on these fundamentals is because we are reimagining this whole system in what we're building with Molecule, with IP NFTs, with IP tokens. And the creativity that at least the space where I sort of draw my creativity from as an IP lawyer here arises from going back to the fundamentals and moving beyond what we're taught, why this thing exists and how it should function. The system starts to make sense and it has a lot of logic that makes sense if you accept certain initial assumptions. But if you can challenge the initial assumptions, things start to unlock in a way that I think open up paths to see new ways of reorganizing this right to exclude. And doing so even in ways that I think can enable an IP system, be it the public kind of one that exists, or maybe even a more privatized one that we begin to co-create inside DAOs or inside DeFi or inside Web3, in a way that is compatible with funding the commons, retroactive public good funding, th things like this that otherwise fall completely outside of the logic of sort of the typical sort of modern capitalism and in how things are typically structured. So that's why I hone in there, but would love to hear. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that makes sense, and Jesse always has great insights into this stuff as well.
Well, it's perfect because you're talking about this imaginary thing, this intangible thing. And a criticism that people often make of cryptocurrency is that they're imaginary currencies. The game is made up and the points don't matter. I think that that's a point that can be heavily contested, but it does make imaginary property a perfect bedfellow of cryptocurrency.
Yeah,
Absolutely.
absolutely. And as when I sort of locate these in the global economy, and I would argue fiat currency is just no different, is just a less secure form of cryptocurrency, right? It's not backed by anything. It's made up. It sort of follows the weight of its own system. And between capital and intangible assets, which are largely what we can say as a proxy is just intellectual property is what creates the boundaries of intangible assets, are now comprise 80% of the balance sheets of Fortune 500 companies. WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, which is the UN body that oversees a few major international IP treaties like the Berne Convention and a few of these others, and who are monitoring kind of the IP economy, last year estimated that the value of intellectual property in the global economy is now north of $70 trillion in intangible assets. 50 years ago, the balance sheets of high-tech companies were about 20% intangibles and 80% tangibles. That's now been inverted, 80% intangibles and 20% tangibles. And so much like people have written and thought about the financialization of the global economy over the past few decades. Really, we've really since 1994, since the TRIPS agreement, the trade-related aspects of intellectual property, which is part of the WTO, and all WTO members have to accept this IP system. We're only, what, 30 years in, and we've seen this IPification of the global economy in ways that I think when we do, pair capital and IP, I mean, we're kind of talking about the real core. Anything that shifts those two end things will fundamentally shift the entire economy.
Yeah. But I think the point that you're nailing in on, which is super important to kind of recapitulate, is the fact that both capital and intellectual property are intangible assets. You know, they're one might look at them as fugazi, fugazi, wazi, it's a woozy. Another person might look at it like, you know, these are just basically the bubbles that never burst, right? The value is perceived, but it is real. Because it is predictive over, you know, potential cash flow and things that, but even that definition is circular because cash flow is capital, which is, you know, also this intangible asset. So, ultimately, it is the value that with which we give it, which is, you know, where all of the stuff bottoms out in the first place. But would really love to kind of bring this back. I know we've been kind of getting very philosophical and abstract, but. There are some important things to report on from on the product side that we've been working on that people probably have a lot of questions about. So really wanted to transition there and give you guys kind of the forum to answer a lot of questions which we've personally been getting and we get constantly, which is, you know, okay, I have this piece of IP or I have this research project I want to work on. Maybe I have a patent, maybe I don't even have a patent yet. How do I create an IP NFT? Why would I want to create an IP NFT? And then what are IP tokens and you know why does all this stuff matter, you know, when I can just go this alternative route? So yeah, Jesse, like go for it. We'd love to hear from your perspective first. Then we'll hand it over to Chris.
Sure. Thanks, Benji. And let's start with what is an IP NFT and, you know, why would I want to mint one? It goes back to the very first thing that Molecule launched, which was crowdfunding of a research project at the University of Toronto, studying the effects of mushroom microdosing. And the idea there was if we allow a crowd to fund this project and give that crowd rights to the IP that can emerge from the project. And as Chris said, IP is it's very broad, right? So it includes the R&D data that may emerge, not just patents that may emerge. Then we've facilitated basically a peer-to-peer crowdfunding of science. And so, you know, from the very beginning, Molecule's been focused on exactly this. The question is that they came to me with is how do we translate that? Those set of agreements into something that is on chain. Because at the fundamental level, an NFT, it's just a token, right? It's just an entry of a few lines of code. And ERC20 is even fewer lines of code. And onto that token, you can map all kinds of stuff. It's almost like a piece of paper. Depending upon what you write on the piece of paper, the nature of the token can change, depending on how it ties into the different protocols that you build, the way and the utility of the token can change. Anything from directing liquidity into curve pools using convex finance to a representation of a punk that you can use as your personal brand opening up a restaurant. And I think there, very specifically in those NFTs, is the space where IP innovation is happening. And so when Paul and Tyler, the founders of Molecule, came to me with this question of how do we build this system of tying legal contracts for research and the IP that results from research to smart contracts on Ethereum, after thinking about it for a bit, I realized that the solution is very simple. What you do is you take your original legal agreement, that sponsored research agreement for science that gives you rights to IP. And you assign that through an assignment agreement, it's literally a one-page agreement that we worked with DLA Piper to develop, to an NFT. And so by entering into that initial research agreement and then assigning it to an NFT, you've taken this two steps of legal contract attached to this smart contract. And all of a sudden, you have an on-chain object that represents your rights to the IP and any other rights you have to the research that you've sponsored. And why is that important, right? Why would a scientist want to do that? Well, to me, it's a logical next step in the evolution of what a legal contract is represented as. Initially, they were handshake agreements in oral societies, and they've evolved from there to written paper agreements that people mailed back and forth to each other and stored in file folders, to electronic agreements that we store, in Google Drive or in other secure data storage. And the next logical step for me from that is storing them on chain as non-fungible tokens, attached to non-fungible tokens and inside of the non-fungible tokens, so that anybody who looks at the NFT and digs into it, accesses the secure data archive attached to it, is able to view the agreement, understand the rights that it contains, and then even share that or trade it or sell it to another party in a much easier way, potentially, than they could sell an agreement of the older versions, a hard piece of paper or something in a Google Drive. And they can not only sell it in a much smaller pool, but a much larger pool of global participants. And so for the scientist who wants to get their research funded, minting an IPNFT is a chance to bring that research and the rights related to it into this new democratized global pool of supporters and draw from that pool a group of people from maybe all around the world who are interested in the research, who can help to fund it, who can help to direct the direction of it, and who can participate in it in all kinds of different ways. So hopefully that gives an understanding of what the IPNFT is. It's really just two legal contracts attached to a smart contract. Why an IPNFT is compelling to mint. And then one more thing to answer your question is why IPTs? And I'd actually turn this over to Chris, because the origin of IPTs comes in many ways from work that Chris and I were doing at VitaDAO, where the deal flow team came to us in the legal department and said, "Hey, we want to fractionalize a piece of one of our IPNFTs. We want to take this IPNFT that we hold as a DAO, and we want to distribute rights to it to our community because we want to foster more community involvement in it, a more granular level and a deeper level of tokenization." And in answer to that, Chris developed the kind of foundational model for what we have today as IPTs, which was called Friends. And Chris, what does Friends stand for, and where'd that come from?
Yeah, so FRIENDS stands for Fair, Reasonable, Ethical, and Non-Discriminatory Sublicense. It sounds like a forced acronym, right? But it actually comes out of another long acronym that exists in the traditional IP licensing space called FRAND licensing, which stands for Fair, Reasonable, and Non-Discriminatory Licensing. FRAND arises out of antitrust law, out of concerns that when you have a really powerful piece of intellectual property that everyone should, perhaps need, let's say it's a patent over a USB port or something,
Or a drug.
or a drug, right? Right. If you know that everyone needs this in order to participate in a business, and with drugs in the IP world, it takes a different path through compulsory licensing, which has another vehicle for it. But it's a great example, Jesse. But to play with the USB one, the idea is you want to have a bunch of compute. The market is for computers, and everyone, you want to have one port. Otherwise, you end up with, right, a million different ports, a million different chargers. Well, if you're the person who owns the patent over that one port, what's to keep you from charging like just a completely monopolistic type, irrational and inefficient price? So, from an economics perspective, this FRAND, which means have to license to anyone at a fair royalty rate. What we were thinking about in converting all things into Web3 with friends was to kind of grab the cultural and social importance of what's happening in this conventional economic space and bring it into DAOs and say, well, we also want to have this be fair, reasonable, ethical, and non-discriminatory licensing amongst DAO members. We don't want there to be these nationalisms or classisms or things like this that are all over the kind of traditional IP economy. And we add one word in particular there, ethical, that really jumps out. And why ethical? Well, we don't really today in the IP system enable inventors or authors to really voice their kind of IP morals or what we may say. I mean, so many scientists are motivated to develop new drugs because they actually care about those drugs helping people. There is a true noble kind of genuine motivation, I think, that motivates a lot of scientists. And, you know, for many reasons, obviously they have to be employed. When they assign their IP over to their company, to a corporation, that corporation is bound through its obligations to be profit maximizing. And I'm sure, you know, we don't have to spend too much time talking about how raw, brute profit maximization and ethical economies can align, but they don't always. And you know, structural inequities are kind of the product of these misalignments. So what we got to thinking was, what if we could take an IP NFT and also imbue it with the values of a DAO? You know, with the thing that's also brought us all together, and to say, look, we're all chipping money in here to help sponsor this research. The last thing we want is to have the IP from this research end up in a patent that's going to end up in the hands of a traditional big player who has a history and a track record of not being so ethical with how they wield their IP, how they handle pricing, who they allow to have access to the drug, all of these things. And is there something we can do through tokenized IP that would allow the community to actually come together and start to propose and vote on what would be deemed ethical encumbrances in the IP license? An ethical encumbrance is really just a contractual clause like you would imagine in any other contract or license that you sign. But an ethical encumbrance really fits in what we would consider an IP morals clause, is kind of the legal lingo there. And what it says is, This, once you put it on a piece of property, it sticks onto that property for life if you do it well. And so what you can do is have early funders, you know, where that competition over the incentive of, I really need to extract as much profits as possible from this. Fair enough, you have, obviously that's going to happen. But when people are still sort of early in and idealistic, you say, well, let's put the kind of non-negotiables on there now. Let's say that this can be anything from pricing caps on how much overcharge a particular price may be for a drug that's gone to market. Let's say perhaps that includes, well, anyone involved in the supply chain or in the value chain commercializing this IP, perhaps that value chain, if they're to have a valid license or right to practice the IP, has to have fair pay. You know, across gender equities, and perhaps has to have automatic redistribution, reciprocity back to perhaps indigenous communities who've long been stewarding a lot of really important medicine. In the psychedelic space, this comes up often. So all of a sudden we have this opportunity when we're thinking about tokenized IP to add this ethical component. Mm-hmm. Now, so we start with friends, and this morphed and ultimately evolved into IPTs today, intellectual property tokens, which flow out, you know, are tokenized from an IP NFT and actually allow the token holders to co-govern the commercialization and the development and really the ethics of that development of a given IP NFT project. the flexibility that we provide for IPT, for IP token holders, is enormous. We don't mean to be prescriptive in creating this protocol. We want to allow communities to experiment and to do whatever they can with governance. There's a certain freedom there that I think is really important to embrace and to allow for experimentation and sort of IP NFT pools, IP pools as a laboratory. But what we've really done is create something that's completely unprecedented in the IP economy. There have been and continue to be IP pools, what are sometimes also considered intellectual property commons, where entities have pooled their IP together for some collective purpose. In the patent space, this may look like pooling patents for life-saving drugs. The Open COVID Pledge most recently was an effort to have entities pool their IP and essentially ensure that IP licensing and friction wouldn't get in the way of mutual collaboration in developing the technologies and medicines that we need to effectively end the COVID pandemic. And in the copyright space, people are more familiar with this with things like Creative Commons, or even open source software is technically an IP pool, an IP commons. But what none of those have ever done is enable a system where there can actually be active participation and co-governance, along with a system that can provide ongoing incentivization to remain active and to actually allow the fruits of that co-created and sort of co-governed effort to flow back to token holders. And this is where I think IPTs get really exciting. They're in some ways vehicles for a cooperative, one may think, a cooperative effort in sort of co-developing and co-managing IP. It can also take different forms, really any form of organized group governance and dynamics that one may want.
Cool. Anything else to add there, Jesse?
Just one thing, and that's the efficiencies created by this. Harkening back to your comment about WIPO and their estimate that IP on the books of the global corporations is around $70 trillion or more dollars. I have a hunch that that's super inefficient pricing, and that a lot of that is maybe overvalued. Some of it might be undervalued. That's not to say that corporations don't use that IP as collateral. Corporations even use their brand IP as collateral to get loans. American Airlines did it for a loan from the government during COVID, for example, just their brand name. But I think that as you take that IP on the books, but not on chain, and you bring it on chain, and you enable it to be governed by these pools of people, the wisdom of the crowd comes into play, pricing of the crowd comes into play, and open market pricing comes into play of the IP, we actually help to create a lot more efficiencies in the IP pricing market using IPTs. IP tokens.
Yeah, absolutely. And to add another on that vein of efficiencies, simply having IP ownership and IP title on chain itself, which is at the IP NFT level, that alone already creates massive efficiencies for IP licensing deals that involve a high volume of patents, of what may be sort of a number of IP NFTs. For example, when I was at RPX, we would do licensing deals that would oftentimes have thousands, if not tens of thousands, of patents and patent applications involved in the bulk deal. And it may take, deals would get held up sometimes for months, and we'd be spending $50,000, $60,000 in due diligence costs just to confirm title of who actually owned that IP, if the entity who was sort of licensing that IP or selling that IP was actually the owner and had the rights to do so. Imagine when that's on chain. You just run a quick check on Etherscan or whatever it may be, and you can quickly, you do it in a day, and it would take nothing. And one other thing I guess I should note just for the people who might be listening closely and hearing these ideas of co-ownership of IP and things that otherwise may be confusing. This question comes up a lot and has come up a lot, and that we designed for it in our kind of protocol here. There remains only one legal owner of the intellectual property that we're dealing with here. The IP NFT owner is the owner, the legal owner, the one with legal title, and them alone, to the intellectual property that is getting tokenized into the IPTs. This is really important because of how the IP system works across jurisdictions. There's different sort of rules around what happens if you have co-owners of IP. And for a host of reasons, it's never a good idea to have multiple legal owners, people with legal title to the same IP. So instead, what we're also doing with these pools is, again, really focusing in on co-governance and enabling that co-governance to inform and, you know, through contracts can be binding on the IP owner in terms of how that IP should be out-licensed or further developed. But just for anyone, IP lawyers or others out there listening who think this is a mess for this reason, we've already solved for that. So we got you there.
Thanks for solving lawyers' problems, Chris. Appreciate that.
We'll keep you in the know.
So, I mean, you touched on this, which is, you know, just the massive transaction costs that exist just in order to confirm ownership over, you know, a piece of IP or a specific right associated with that IP. Just confirming that in and of itself costs, you know, many legal hours, which we know don't come cheap. But I think, you know, some of the other stuff we're trying to innovate on and really think about automating are the most expensive transactions that exist within the IP system. So would love to understand, like, you know, how do we think about digitizing the process of like IP licensing? What does the IP licensing process look like today? You know, how many lawyers are involved? How long does it take? What are they actually doing that's so expensive? And how do we bring the cost of that to the cost of gas on ETH?
Yeah, I mean, any answer I'm going to give here is going to get me in trouble with all my other IP lawyer friends, right?
Because a magician never reveals his tricks.
spill the dirt. Because of all of these structural inefficiencies in the IP system, it, particularly with low quality IP, and then with structuring a deal and figuring out how value should flow, what types of milestones need to be met for value to flow, there's an infinite number of things that you can always have an IP lawyer do to further tighten up a deal. Imagine you're about to do a really big deal and you think the patent's invalid. There's patent lawyers. I mean, most of my work has always been invalidating patents, and in the bar of patent, you know, invalidators, if you ask enough of us, you find people who say every patent is invalid. It's just a matter of paying me enough money to boil the ocean, to dig through enough references of prior art or academic literature or things that weren't in front of the patent office to prove it. And, you know, while that sentiment's a bit extreme, if anyone wants to take a bet on that, for $10 million, I bet you I can
validate that. You said it the other day, 70% are found invalid.
So 50% litigated on the merits in district court, and then it was 69-70% of patents were found invalid that were challenged at the USPTO, the PTAB, which enabled a new process about a little over a decade ago to bring direct challenges to patentability at the office. Now, it's true there's a selection bias there in terms of the patents that are going to be challenged are likely to be ones where one can prevail, but that selection bias also goes the other way, in which people are attacking the strongest patents that are being asserted. And yeah, that the success rate, once you had a panel of sophisticated technical judges, these are administrative law judges, interacting with really expert technical witnesses and highly technical attorneys, no jury, you're able to actually get to what is frankly a better outcome. You're actually discerning what is innovative or isn't, and you're exactly it completely undercuts the patent quality that we can expect from a patent office. And just to provide a little context as to what that looks like as well, your given patent examiner has a really heavy docket. They may, on average, have about 10 hours to actually do a review of your patent application. They're searching across a database that's largely comprised of patent prior art. They'll catch some stuff that's academic literature publications, but they're not catching anywhere near as much of that when you're really digging in. And they're a single person. Many of them have a bachelor's degree, some may have a master's or a PhD, but they've had limited time in the industry, and they're incentivized to grant patents. The patent offices across the world have moved to begin to think of patent applicants as clients. This is a client service whereas for a long time it was a bit more adversarial. You'd be negotiating the scope of a patent claim. The shift, that's still kind of it, but the shift has been more and more towards clientelism. Those things obviously start to benefit repeat players more often. You just create a system that's ripe for structural bias. And it's because of this, it's the small bucket with which examiners who are overworked have that they may be issuing patents that shouldn't issue.
So I guess coming back to that, which is, we specifically work in the area of drug development, which, the way to index drugs, I mean, it depends on the drug modality, but we'll keep things simple and say, these composition of matter patents can be boiled down to a compound structure, right? And that is basically the unique entity that can be patented, right? Whether that's the structure of some psychedelic or some cancer drug, whatever it is, that is the grain or like unique index at which things can be represented as intellectual property. So if you could design a better system where there didn't need to be a ton of like manual labor, whether it's a lawyer or not, to go through and be like, is this a unique, non-obvious, compound? How would you design that system, ideally digitally?
Yeah, I would use AI. I mean, I think AI is the future of patent examination. I think putting things on chain and really further developing what zero knowledge proofs can do with AI and with enough information in the back to figure out if this is a unique fingerprint or something like that, meaning a unique molecule, something that's actually innovative in structure. Is achievable, and those are, I mean, what you're describing is the right. That's where patents are actually easy, and the system kind of works better because once you have this, it is akin to looking for fingerprints on a glass or on anything. If it's there or not very quickly. You might be able to do some spectroscopy, something like this. You figure out what's in there. It's these method claims, it's these other things that are abstract in nature that require claim construction. So you've described stuff. And then those words, which are inherently, like a Noam Chomsky would point out, like all language is fluid and it is layered with cultural context and stuff. Where the system really fails and why it's so expensive is if you have to do what's considered claim construction, which means a court has to figure out what does this claim mean in the first place? And so then you start building dictionaries of words that are in the claims themselves, and you fight forever over what that means. That part of the system, I think, I mean, for the molecule side, I think we can do this on chain and do AI. Absolutely. I think when it comes to method claims, which are you know, valuable as well, method of extraction, a method of isolating some compounds, stuff like this can have really great market value. Those as well, certainly AI is also just going to be a phenomenal resource. But in an ideal system, if we really link this into what we're building with BioDAOs, I think we have a brain trust in every BioDAO that far surpasses the brain trust of an individual patent examiner sitting in the office in Alexandria, Virginia. And what we can do to have human validation alongside some AI screening in order to help us figure out is this novel or isn't it, is just a far more efficient path. But what that does, though, is it starts to push, unless the public system is going to fundamentally change, it starts to push the whole IP system onto a private on-chain network. And that gets interesting to also improve things like IP dispute settlement. And I think we are going to end up seeing essentially an on-chain private patent office in some way that's fully transparent. It's going to be publicly accessible, but it's going to be on chain. And if we can then use the brain trust from our different BioDAOs to help arbitrate disputes over potential IP infringement that has cropped itself up and been validated on chain, we're going to have a far cheaper and more efficient means of resolving IP disputes than having to go through the legacy system where you're paying lawyers to file all your briefs and conform with all these other IP or all these other justice system requirements that frankly continue to fail and generate the inefficiencies. So I'm really excited. And I think fundamentally, none of this matters. Like IP going back to its core, it's a right to exclude. It doesn't get enforced automatically. One has to go out, put the energy in to wield their own right to exclude in order to stop someone from infringing that patent, which means one has to trigger and confront another in a dispute where they've detected the sort of problematic behavior. All that matters is if you get to the dispute, and then all that matters is how cheap is it to resolve the dispute. So having a new layer and a new system through which we can more transparently and efficiently resolve IP disputes is, in my mind, the future of the real value add in BioDAOs, and is also, I think, what the legal primitives that we're building are sort of creating a platform for.
Yeah, and I'm just trying to like put on a more of a skeptical hat here and like look at the context of what we're doing in this larger like public goods funding and, you know, more trying to enable open source science. And to me, it's like I'm starting to get where a lot of people in the DeSci movement who disagree with what we're doing have pushback on, which comes down to this like exclusionary nature of IP, right? Like that's where the pushback comes from. It's like, are you really working on DeSci and like open science if you're just trying to reinvent the way we exclude people from using your science, right? It's a little hypocritical in a way. It's like, you know, we're both trying to enable this system that you're saying is grounded on the fact of being able to exclude people, but also trying to open up science. So I guess like, you know, from an outsider's perspective, like how would you say we're actually moving the needle on open and decentralized science while at the same time trying to figure out how do we optimize the way we exclude people from using our science?
Mm-hmm. I could jump in for just a moment because I think that it's very important to highlight this idea of progressive decentralization or opening up, the process of opening up. So what IPTs do is they open up IP NFTs. What was previously much more exclusionary, single token holder, single owner, single controller of the licensing function, opens up with IPTs to something that has this group of people. So there's more people who have access, more people who can help govern. It's kind of permissionless to exit and enter. So if you're somebody who's interested in engaging with the IP, in helping to develop it, you can join the group. You can become a token holder and you can start to govern it. You can start to help develop it. So that's progressively opening up what was previously a closed and very exclusionary system. And so I think it's a stepwise process towards opening up more and more and more. And it harkens back to what Chris developed with the Friends system, which is this idea of IP commoning, right? What happens when you create a Creative Commons? There's still some exclusionary limitations on a Creative Commons, on an MIT license, for example. There's still exclusionary limitations on any of these commoning systems, or even a public park. There's some things you just can't do in a public park. Similarly, with the IP system, I think it's important to remind oneself that some of the ways of exclusion, of some of the exclusionary things are good. Just like on blockchains and open systems, like you can't use Solana to pay for gas on Ethereum. You have to do certain things, play by certain rules in order to participate in what is a much more open economy and a much more open system, but it's progressively becoming more and more decentralized and more open.
Yeah, and I totally agree. And I would add, I'm even in some of my academic work, I'm pretty critical of this sort of extremist, what I would consider a particular form of ideological open source, because copyright, because all open source licensing is still built on a right to exclude. It's, you take a It's only because the copyright applies that you can wield a copyleft license, right? You're wielding this exclusion to exclude the things that you choose. And the terms that are embedded in what are the traditional open source licenses and open access licensing are political decisions. Whether or not you choose to, for example, I'm hot right now because I'm in Spain. Last week it was snowing and hailing in northern Spain, and today it's 60 degrees Celsius, 140 degrees Fahrenheit in western Spain. Climate change is coming. I'm not too sympathetic to anyone who wants to maybe argue climate change isn't real. Open source software, just on its own, fuels supply chains that are exacerbating climate change. So if one actually wants to make an intervention into the problem that we're trying to solve, which hopefully is something that's really for the public good, the benefit of public good more generally, which I think, in this climate change or access to medicines are things that we want to do. If you just don't use IP at all, and you just throw your hands up and throw away the power that you have as a creator in developing this in the first place, there's an ethical responsibility that I think one arguably should bear, especially if one wants to critique the flip side of saying, well, I'm going to wield my right to exclude the bad stuff. This thing is free for everyone so long as you don't. And then insert what, right? Insert that, in filling in that blank is really where things, I think, where we're playing around, right? We're not saying leave that blank, the structure is fine as it is, and we just need to give our IP over to what? To the dominant market players? If no IP exists, then the dominant market players are going to continue to be even bigger monopolists, and whatever their particular interests are and their politics are going to be what we're implicitly supporting. So can we open things up and do the hard work of saying, what problem are we actually trying to solve? How can we open up IP to help solve that social problem? And IP isn't the problem, right? The problem is all this other type of oppression and exclusion that happens in the system within which IP participates. So, oftentimes the open source people also just focus the public domain or just focus, well, but in IP, leave the climate, leave the access to medicines to other law. And oh, then they just punt. It's a punt, right? Someone else will handle it. Well, 30 years ago, maybe that was okay when IP wasn't 80%, wasn't a $70 trillion asset. It's a $70 trillion asset class. Now, today, one just can't say that IP isn't inside and one of the most dominant forces inside a bigger structure. And so I think we have to locate IP in that structure and then make decisions about how we open things up with an eye towards how that bigger structure is affecting the ultimate kind of thing we want to accomplish. End rant, sorry. Some passion around this.
No, it's good. Love the passion. Most passionate lawyer I've ever met. So I guess what I'm find myself trying to explain to people the importance of what we're doing is often boils down to getting people to think about financing IP instead of financing entities. Because ultimately, like that's what the IP NFT is, right? It's this kind of own vehicle to fundraise around and to value versus like within a company, right, which has a portfolio of individual IP assets. So I don't know how much you guys have thought about this in the context of biotech. I certainly think about it a lot because, there's so much incentive within a biotech company to continue a program because the company is centered around the IP. Right. And people's jobs are basically derivatives of the IP. So if you drop the program, you basically have to fire people. So I don't know if you guys have any thoughts here, but I'd love to understand from your perspective, what does a world look like in which IP is financed directly and people are basically, service providers for all of these different pieces of IP rather than employees of a company? What does that world look like to you? And why is it, better or worse than the system we have now?
Well, for what it's worth, when people get together to operate some kind of thing for revenue, for profit, the law is going to find a company no matter what. So, generally it's called a general partnership. And corporations are people too. It's really just groups of people working together on a common goal. So it's kind of inescapable, even if it's direct funding of IP through a scientist minting an IP NFT and then selling IPTs to bootstrap a group of people to help govern the project and direct the research, you're still kind of creating an inchoate company there. But what you're doing, instead of having to form a corporation with the Secretary of State in any particular country, is you're forming that company on the state machine of Ethereum, which is a much lower barrier to entry. It's much more fluid. It's much more global. And it allows you to coordinate and govern and efficiently price and efficiently license and sell and do all these things that make the IP more of an interactive, active asset. And so, that world kind of already exists in many ways, I think. The world of kind of people working just for the development of IP. It's just that they do it within corporations, like you said, Benji. But even in a world where the corporation isn't formed, there are still inchoate companies that are formed by people working together to develop IP.
Yeah, and my thinking is that if we moving towards an economy that is IP centered, we the losers are going to be those who are able to extract a lot of money, middle management, lawyers, right? The people who aren't involved necessarily in the IP development in creation in its first instance, and are really good at doing other things inside the corporate hierarchies and ladders, but it's such a vertical with all types of inefficiencies inside those silos that you start to eliminate a lot of jobs that are there, and that's hard. I mean, this does do something that really centers and kind of elevates the creators, the inventors. And that's why, too, I think it's really important to go back again to some of these first principles. Like, doesn't that feel bad? Isn't that just choosing people who maybe are more creative or something? Like, well, maybe, and maybe that's fine as well, because it's somewhat arbitrary where this comes. It's a political decision around how, an economic decision around how value should flow. But we are all capable and all every day produce IP. I mean, the vast majority of us, anyone probably watching this podcast, gets their salary because they generate IP, be it through, I mean, any type of work, be it if it's just writing messages, content, media, marketing, all of that stuff is IP. And so I think if we think about how to feel that and kind of play with it a bit, we may end up in a system that feels more humanizing. One of the biggest things that I think, I mean, disillusionment among you know, if you talk to three academics, you'll hear four opinions about how disillusioned they are with academia, because it's a system that just ends up having people feel very alienated, have people feel very disconnected from their creative works. And I think there's something there. I don't know. I'm sure it can go wrong in a lot of different ways. And I'm trying to think of some of the positive ways that help us feel more human inside a system that can feel very disconnected. But I see this path of what we're building as something that really helps to further humanize and connect us to our own creations and to the ethics upon which our creations are commercialized.
Like a stakeholder economy for science.
Love it. So I guess one question, and I think we should probably cap it off here, but let's imagine a world where there are no governments and you are exclusively reliant on the blockchain to enforce the IP with regard to medicines. You have researchers, generating these compounds that are IP. They want to be able to send it around to patients. And they're basically reliant on this digital system to enforce the excludability. If you haven't thought about this before, then feel free to pass. But if you have, would really love to understand how is this problem solved with smart contracts? And I think you touched on this a bit, Chris, of like, the BioDAOs kind of doing these patent disputes. But what does that actually look like? And what's like, how do you enforce violence here, basically, to make sure that the right people are excluded?
Yeah, I mean, I think about these things a lot and really appreciate the question. And I think that this doesn't work. I think that this path, if someone wants to annihilate the IP system, do what we're doing. This generates crisis inside a system because it doesn't work. You have to have a military backing a government that is capable of actually policing and enforcing exclusion over imaginary property, in my mind. So if we get to our end game where there is where essentially the revolution has succeeded, there are no more state governments in some way, if we think of that type of revolutionary goal. I also think that there's no IP. The only IP that exists becomes trade secrets, which is essentially information that itself is locked up, behind some cryptographic, token gated wall, and that can't be reverse engineered or readily discerned from the use of that information in the public. And so in that way too, I mean, I guess for the anarchists out there who are looking for that revolutionary potential and who are anti-IP, my kind of take on that is like, you're not going to win. Like this is enshrined in global trade agreements and in constitutions. So unless you're going to go armed revolution and knock those things down, you're better off actually, getting involved in a system that pulls it away from a police state and from a military state and creates crisis in that state and in the legacy structures of power. And then things kind of crumble. And what comes after that, I have no idea. A new IP system, I'm sure, can emerge. But I don't, every time I get there in my thinking, it just turns into like a Black Mirror episode. It gets pretty dystopic. So that's probably grim and overly radical for the purposes of the podcast, but I'm glad you asked.
Nothing like liberation theology informing a perspective on intellectual property. You know, it's the teleological progress of the human soul towards liberation. You can't escape it. I would add that it's already happening. What you described as part of the end game of trade secrets without patents or anything. Trade secrets that are protected with cryptography, protected with access restrictions. And a great example of that is Twitter's restriction of people scraping their data, which is their IP, right? The data that's on the platform is part of this umbrella of their intellectual property. And they're throttling access to that because people are coming and taking what you could say are kind of trade secrets or whatever. Not really, but it's data without permission. And so by putting this wall of permission, cryptographic wall of permission, you build this kind of new system that allows for the protection of IP on chain cryptographically without the need for an intervention from a third party. It's just like pay the toll to get the key to access the trade secret and the data, and that all happens via smart contract.
Yeah, and maybe just to add, I totally, that's a great point. And I would say to point people specifically to the Sarah Silverman case that she just filed against Meta and OpenAI, and the case against Midjourney and Stability Diffusion, which are copyright cases against AI. Those cases are exposing and are highlighting the crisis that I'm describing new technology is bringing to the legacy IP system. In my opinion, the copyright system, it can't handle what has happened with AI scraping these large data sets, and the jurisdictional splits that already are appearing between Japan, UK, US are going to be devastating to a coherent copyright framework, and we're going to have to build a whole new one. And so if people want to watch a crisis unfold in the legal system, it's happening there first.
Awesome. Well, thanks for leaving it at a crisis. Great spot to leave it. But yeah, no, really appreciate your guys' super deep thoughts and like thought leadership around, you know, digitizing IP, code as law, you know, pushing us in a world where we can ideally become sovereign of jurisdictional governments to enforce the creations of our mind. But, you know, sounds like we'll always be reliant on them, which is you know, not what I wanted to hear, but maybe we can convince you and, you know, do a subsequent podcast where we go more in depth about the actual designs of the protocol to where we can digitize this completely.
Thanks.
Thanks a ton. Talk soon, guys. Bye. Thanks everyone for listening. Soon.